The Principles of Economics, Lecture 8. Supply, Demand, and Equilibrium. How Prices Are Set in Our Markets.
Hi, I'm Peter Navarro, and in this lecture, we're going to begin our journey through the other major branch of economics known as microeconomics. In these next 7 lectures, we are going to see that the study of microeconomics deals with the behavior of individual markets and the businesses, consumers, investors, and workers that make up the broader macroeconomy. This is a subject that focuses on issues like how prices are set in the places where we shop, how the wages we earn are determined by our employers, how rents are set in the buildings where we live or do business, and why the government is sometimes forced to regulate industries that are either too concentrated or monopolistic. As I discussed with you in the introductory lecture, at a business and professional level, microeconomics can help answer questions like, how can my firm minimize its costs and increase its profits? What prices should I charge for my products? Should I invest in new plant and equipment? And how should I respond to an aggressive strategic move by one of my competitors? At a personal level, microeconomics is equally practical. It can help answer questions like, will I really be better off financially if I quit my job now and go back for an MBA degree? What kind of career should I be preparing myself for? And what about that new refrigerator or automobile I want to buy? Should I get the new energy-efficient one with the higher price tag, or settle for the cheaper model? Most broadly, microeconomics can also help you come to understand why the government is so involved in our economic lives. It can do so by answering questions like, why does the government regulate prices in some industries, like electricity and gas, but not in others? Why are there laws requiring seatbelts and motorcycle helmets? Why do we have a federal Environmental Protection Agency and thousands of rules about workplace safety? And why does the government provide some goods like our national defense and lighthouses and let the free market provide other goods like hot dogs and computers? So, in this first lecture on microeconomics, I'm going to introduce you to one of the most powerful and important concepts in my profession, that of supply, demand, and equilibrium. In particular, I'm going to introduce the supply and demand curves and then explain how the forces of supply and demand lead to an equilibrium in the market and thereby set market prices. Perhaps most interestingly, we'll see that the market price reaches its competitive equilibrium at precisely where the demand and supply curves cross, where the forces of demand and supply are just in balance. Before we go there, however, I want to start with the 3 basic questions that any economy must answer. What shall be produced? How shall it be produced? And for whom shall it be produced for? In answering these 3 basic questions, 3 basic facets of economic and political life must be addressed: scarcity, efficiency, and equity. Take scarcity first. If infinite quantities of every good could be produced, there would not be economic goods. That is, goods that are scarce or limited in supply. All goods would be free, like sand in the desert or seawater at the beach. In such an Eden of affluence, people wouldn't have to worry about stretching out their limited incomes to fulfill their wants. Businesses wouldn't worry about costs and profits when they produced their products. Governments wouldn't have to tax their citizens to build things like roads and bridges, and there would be no distinction or political and economic conflict between rich and poor because everyone would have everything they needed and wanted. Accordingly, prices and markets would be irrelevant, and economics would not be a useful subject. Well, clearly, no society has reached such a utopia of limitless possibilities. Instead, while goods are limited, wants are seemingly limitless. Indeed, even after 2 centuries of rapid economic growth, production in the United States is still not high enough to meet everyone's desires. And outside the United States, particularly in Africa, hundreds of millions of people suffer from hunger and material deprivation every day. Faced with the undeniable fact that goods are scarce relative to wants, an economy must decide how to cope with limited resources. It must choose among different potential bundles of goods, That's the what. Select from different techniques of production. That's the how. And decide, in the end, who will consume the goods. That's the for whom. In a very real sense, then, the essence of economics is to acknowledge the reality of scarcity and then figure out how to organize society in a way that produces the most efficient use of resources. Efficiency denotes the most effective use of a society's resources in satisfying people's wants and needs. As we shall see in subsequent lectures, allocating resources efficiently is all the more complicated because in pursuing efficiency, there is almost always a very thorny trade-off between what is efficient from an economic point of view and what may be viewed as fair or equitable from a social and political point of view. In fact, grappling with the trade-off between efficiency and equity is one of the most difficult tasks of economists and the political and business leaders they serve. Consider the case of electricity prices. When we study monopoly, we'll learn that, from a microeconomic point of view, the most efficient way to regulate electricity prices would be to charge individual consumers much more than businesses for the same unit of electricity. However, such a pricing policy creates enormous political problems because it is people rather than businesses that vote in our democratic system. Moreover, many would argue that it simply wouldn't be fair to charge people, especially the poor and elderly, more than the big corporations for that same product. In a similar vein, we will also see that almost any time the government tries to raise taxes to redistribute income from the rich to the poor through mechanisms like food stamps or Medicare, those taxes tend to interfere with the efficiency of the free market. Okay, with that as our broad brush background, let's turn now to our discussion of supply and demand. To begin, I'd like to call upon the British philosopher Thomas Carlyle for a little help, and perhaps a little humor, in this exposition. For Carlyle once said, "Teach a parrot the term supply and demand, and you've got an economist." Of course, microeconomics is not quite that simple, but Carlyle's wry observation does hit on a basic truth, namely that the concepts of supply and demand rest at the core of any study of how the market system works. To explore this truth, I've illustrated for you in your course guide a typical supply and demand diagram for a popular product in the consumer market, computers. You can either consult that course guide as you listen to this lecture now, or just begin to get a picture of this diagram in your mind's eye as I describe it. We will start, then, with a vertical axis for the diagram that is going to indicate the price of the product. Then, the quantity of the product will be represented on the horizontal axis of the graph. Now, let's add a demand curve and allow it to slope downward. Of course, this downward slope means that the lower the price of the product, the more consumers will demand of it, a very intuitive result. Then we have a supply curve that slopes up. And this upward slope means that the higher the price that producers can get, the more product they will produce. Another very intuitive result. Finally, with the demand curve sloping downward and the supply curve sloping upwards, the curves naturally cross. And as I will explain in more detail shortly, it is at the point where these two curves cross that we are likely to find the market equilibrium, which tells us how much of the good is sold in the market and at what price. Okay, so that's the basic demand, supply, and equilibrium construct. Now, let's look at each of the pieces, and let's start with the demand curve. As I have already said, the implication of a downward sloping demand curve is that the lower the price, holding other things constant, the more units a consumer will demand. And the higher the price, again holding other things constant, the less the consumer will demand. This is not just common sense. It's also an important principle based on very careful scientific observation. It's called the law of demand. Now let's ask ourselves the question, why does the quantity demanded of a good tend to fall as its price rises? Well, there are actually two reasons. First, there is what microeconomists call a substitution effect. Thus, when the price of a good like beef rises, I will substitute other similar goods for it, like chicken or pork. However, a second reason why the quantity demanded falls as price rises is what microeconomists call the income effect. You can think about this income effect in this way. When, say, the price of beef rises, your purchasing power will decline. This lowering in purchasing power means you will tend to buy less of the good. Now, if you were really paying close attention a few minutes ago, you may have noticed that I snuck in the phrase, holding other things constant. That's a common device used in economics, holding other things like income constant. This device is used because such an assumption allows us to sort out the specific effects of that which we are focusing upon, which in this case is changes in price. By doing so, economists can isolate the effects of specific changes in a market. I mention this now because I next want to talk about how the demand curve can actually shift outwards, indicating higher demand, or inwards, indicating lower demand. As to why and how these demand curves shift, well, here's the point. In order to draw the demand curve in two-dimensional price and quantity space, we literally have to hold the other things constant, which also affect consumer demand. Things like income and tastes and the prices of other products. These other factors are what microeconomists call shift factors, because if one of these shift factors changes, the demand curve will shift inwards or outwards. For example, suppose the average income of consumers rises. With more money in their pockets, consumers will tend to buy more of everything. Which way do you think the demand curve will shift in this case? That's right, it will shift outward, just as a fall in income will shift the demand curve inwards. So how about a change in another shift factor, the prices of other goods? Think about this way. Suppose you are analyzing the market for beef and the price of chicken rises. What do you think will happen to the demand curve for beef? Well, the demand curve for beef will shift out. This is because, again, as I noted earlier, beef and chicken are substitutes for each other in the broader market for meat. So, if the price of beef goes up, the demand for chicken will go up too, as indicated by an outward shift of the demand curve for chicken. Other similar examples where you would observe such demand shifts include cornflakes and oatmeal, pens and pencils, and oil versus natural gas. Still another shift factor has to do with consumer tastes. Suppose that tomorrow the American Medical Association publishes a report that says that people who eat prunes regularly live on average several years longer, while people who eat onion rings every day tend, on average, to live several fewer years. What do you think will happen to the demand for prunes and onion rings? Put another way, which way will the demand curve shift for prunes and onion rings? Of course, the demand curve for prunes moves outward, while the demand curve for onion rings, those deadly onion rings, shifts inward. Okay, now let's turn to the other side of the market coin, namely the supply curve. Perhaps most obviously, the location and slope of the supply curve depends on the firm's ability to produce, to transform so-called factors of production, like raw materials and labor and capital, into consumable goods. However, supply also depends on the individual's decisions to supply the factors of production to begin with. That's why later on we'll spend an entire lecture studying how wages and rents and interest rates are set in the labor, land, and capital markets. Now, in explaining supply and the supply curve, let's start with the business analog to the law of demand on the consumer side. This is the so-called law of supply. This law says that the lower the price, holding other things constant, the less units firms will produce, and the higher the price, holding other things constant, the more firms will produce. Now, as with demand curves, there likewise are important shift factors that influence the supply curve. One of the most important is technology. To see this, suppose your company comes up with a new cost-saving computerized process for making cornflakes. What do you think will happen to the supply curve? That's right. The supply curve will shift outwards, meaning that for a given price, supply increases. This is called a change in supply. And it is important to understand that this is a very different thing from a movement along the supply curve from a change in price. Now, how about another shift factor? Input prices. Suppose the price of labor or raw materials increases for cornflakes manufacturers. What happens now to the supply curve? Of course, the supply curve shifts inwards as producers supply less at a given price. Still, a third important shift factor for the supply curve is government policy. This can be a very big cost factor for businesses. For example, if the government imposes stricter environmental regulations, manufacturers will see their costs rise, and the supply curve will shift inwards. While such regulations will improve the quality of the air and water, they will also make goods more expensive. Such regulations, as well as others for health and safety, may even put domestic producers of things like, say, automobiles and steel, at a disadvantage to foreign competitors. Conversely, if Congress removes tariffs and quotas on, say, the auto industry, the supply curve will shift outward as auto imports increase. The point I'm trying to make here is that demand and supply in the marketplace, and ultimately price, are driven by a wide range of factors, from income, the prices of other competing products, and ever-changing consumer tastes on the demand side, to technological change, the prices of production inputs like workers and machinery, and government regulations on the supply end. Okay, now we've got a much better idea of what determines supply and demand in a market. Let's get to the really fun stuff now and talk about how the forces of supply and demand lead to a so-called equilibrium in the market and thereby set the market price. And let's start out by defining what an equilibrium is. The concept itself comes from physics, specifically classical mechanics. To say something is in equilibrium is to say that the dynamic forces pushing on it cancel each other out. In supply and demand analysis, equilibrium means that the upward pressure on price is exactly offset by the downward pressure on price. That is, the equilibrium price is the price towards which the invisible hand of the market drives that market. Consider then the market for cornflakes, where the supply and demand curves cross at a price of 3 and a quantity of 12. That's where we should find the equilibrium in that market. But wait, suppose producers start out by charging a price of 5 instead of 3. In that case, firms are willing to supply more boxes of cornflakes than consumers demand. And the result will be what's called a surplus in the market, where a surplus is simply an excess of quantity supplied over quantity demanded. So what do you think will happen next? Well, you guessed it. With all those extra boxes of cornflakes piling up in their warehouses, firms will start lowering their price, and they will keep lowering it right up until the point that that surplus disappears at exactly the point where the supply and demand curves cross, and the price is 3. Now, how about if instead of the price being too high, it starts out too low in the cornflakes market, say at 2 instead of 3? In this case, consumers will demand more boxes of cornflakes than firms are willing to supply. In this case, the result will be a shortage, that is, an excess of quantity demanded over quantity supplied. So what do you think firms are going to do in this situation? Well, with consumers clamoring for their product, they will raise the price. And they will keep on raising the price right up until it reaches the point where demand and supply are in balance and the market clears. again, at the intersection of supply and demand. By now, you should be beginning to see just how powerful the tools of supply and demand curves are in helping us to predict changes in our market system and prices in our stores. For example, suppose a drought in the Midwest severely damages the wheat harvest. How might you illustrate this scenario in a supply and demand framework? Well, because wheat is a key ingredient of bread, this will shift the supply curve for bread inwards, indicating the higher costs. Note, however, that the demand curve does not shift. This is because people have the same desire for their daily sandwich, whether the harvest is good or bad. So what do you think will happen next? Well, the bad harvest causes bakers to produce less bread at the old price, so quantity demanded exceeds quantity supplied. The price of bread therefore rises, encouraging production and thereby raising quantity supplied. This simultaneously discourages consumption and lowers quantity demanded, and the price continues to rise until at the new equilibrium price, the amounts demanded and supplied are once again equal. Thus, the bad harvest, or any leftward shift of the supply curve, winds up raising prices and, by the law of downward sloping demand, also lowers the quantity demanded. And now let's do a counterexample. Suppose instead that a new baking technology lowers costs and therefore increases supply. What do you think will happen in this market? Well, the positive technology shock will shift the supply curve outwards. This will lead to a new equilibrium point at a lower price and higher quantity consumed. Ah, the wonders of technology. Now, to further demonstrate the power and versatility of the supply-demand equilibrium framework, let me show you how to use it to determine the effects of introducing artificial price controls into the free market. At different times in the history of the United States, for example, different types of price controls have been imposed, either on specific products or on the entire economy. For example, during the 1930s, America's farmers experienced great hardships, from drought, pests, and crop failures to the side effects of the Great Depression. In response, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal began a program of price supports for many of America's agricultural products, from milk, corn, and wheat, to peanuts and sugar. These price support programs set a price floor for the farmers' crops and commodities. If the market price fell below this floor, the government would make up the difference to the farmer, in essence, by buying up any surplus. In this case, the price floor worked to prop up price above the free market equilibrium and thereby help farmers, albeit at the expense of consumers who had to pay higher prices. And just as there are price floors, there are also so-called price ceilings that may be instituted by the government. For example, during World War II, the United States government instituted price controls on most consumer goods. In such a case, the market price might be well above the price ceiling, and at this price ceiling, consumers will demand far more than the market is willing to supply. One way to allocate the resulting shortages in World War II was for the government to actually ration bread supplies. Under such a rationing system, rather than simply take your money to the marketplace and buy bread, you had to first get a ration card giving you the right to the purchase. The interesting thing about this allocation mechanism is that in the presence of price controls and shortages, there can be a very different distribution of bread supplies. Put another way, in a free market, it is the product price that rations supplies, so-called rationing by the purse. However, with price controls, it is the government that can control who it will be that gets the goods that are produced. In this regard, in 1974, the United States experienced a different kind of rationing. When the government put a ceiling on prices at the gas pump in response to the Arab oil embargo, people had to wait in long lines to buy gasoline. In this case, no ration card was necessary to buy gas. All you had to have was time. Lots of time. Okay, we're almost to the end of this lecture. So let's take stock of what the wonderful mechanism of the free market can accomplish for all of us. First, because it is the market determining the equilibrium prices and quantities of all inputs and outputs, it is the free market, not the government, that is allocating or rationing out the scarce goods of society among the possible uses. Second, it is the market and its many price signals that determine just what goods are produced. For example, high oil prices stimulate oil production, whereas low food prices drive resources out of agriculture. Those who have the most money in their pockets, so-called dollar votes, will have the greatest influence on what goods are produced. Third, the market can also answer the question, for whom are goods produced? This is because it is the power of the purse that dictates the distribution of income and consumption. To put it most simply and crudely, it is those with higher incomes who end up with larger houses, more clothing, and longer vacations in a free society and market-based economy. Let's end this lecture now with some examples of how the supply and demand framework can help you save or make money in your professional or personal life. Suppose then, in your daily reading of the newspaper, you notice a small story on the back pages about the possibility in the coming year of something called an El Niño weather condition. For some reason, this story piques your interest. So you get on the internet and do a little more digging and find out that during the last El Niño, winter temperatures were unusually warm while rainfall fell at record levels and flooding plagued much of the country. You also discover on the webpage of a highly respected Australian meteorologist that the chance of El Niño happening in the coming year is quite high. How might you use all this information? Well, it first depends on who you are. Suppose, for example, that you're the chief executive officer of a home heating oil company in Boston. Such news might be your first alert that, because of a warm winter, the demand curve for your product may shift dramatically inward. So, in anticipation of this El Niño condition, you might stock lower inventories of oil and plan for a leaner workforce. Or suppose that you're a stockbroker in Florida managing several billion dollars of pension fund money. You might decide to sell your heating oil stocks and move some of those investment funds into companies that provide things like pest control and allergy medicines. This is because when there is unusually high rainfall, the flowering plants that cause allergies increase their growth dramatically. This shifts out the demand curve for allergy medicines. By the same token, this increased plant growth provides fodder for the food chain, with one of the unfortunate byproducts being that there will be more pests like rats and fleas, thereby increasing the demand for pest control. Now, how about if you're a homeowner in Los Angeles? What would you do about this anticipated El Niño condition? Well, you might want to take some precautions regarding that leaky roof of yours. If you wait too long to call a roofer to fix it, you may find yourself in a very long line paying higher prices as the demand for roofing skyrockets in response to torrential rains. So, you bite the bullet and get the roof fixed now at a much cheaper price than you might have to pay in a few months. Finally, let's do a little bit more complex example here. Let's put yourself in a more perplexing situation where both the supply and demand curves are likely to shift. In such a case, supply and demand analysis can be especially helpful in figuring out what the net effect of such changes on price will be, and thereby help you figure out what your business plan should be. To show you what I mean, suppose you run a large chain of coffee shops in the Pacific Northwest. On the one hand, you know that El Niño may well drive up the cost of cappuccino because it is likely to lead to a bad coffee crop. On the other hand, you also know from your experience with the last El Niño that during unusually wet weather, people drink a lot more coffee. So, what are you going to do? Well, you might go into the coffee futures market and lock into a lower coffee price early, essentially betting that prices will rise later. Be careful, though. El Nino might fizzle and you might be wrong. At the same time, if you decide that any demand effect will overpower a change in supply, you might decide to accelerate the construction of the 50 or more coffee shops you have now on the drawing boards. Of course, in business, it's all a gamble, but as a Chinese philosopher once said, chance favors the prepared mind. Or, in this case, chance favors the prepared microeconomists. Well, that's it for this lesson. In the next lesson, we're going to delve more deeply into the mysteries of demand and supply. In the meantime, please complete the exercises in your course guide. I'm Peter Navarro from the University of California, Irvine, and we'll be talking again soon.
After listening to Lecture 8, a student posed this question to Professor Navarro. You had several examples of how an understanding of microeconomics could help you as an investor. Could you provide another one? Let's listen to the professor's response.
I'd like to give you one of my favorite ones. In fact, it was a title to one of my books, If It's Raining in Brazil, Buy Starbucks. Kind of a funny title, but here's what it means from an investor's point of view. If rain comes to break a drought in Brazil, that means that the coffee crop will be more abundant and coffee prices will go down. When Starbucks sells you those lattes for $1 zillion, they'll actually make a little bit more money on each cup because their costs are down, so their profits will go up, and that will help drive their stock price up. So, if it's raining in Brazil, buy Starbucks.
Another student then asked, you mentioned that an improvement in technology can have a positive impact on a market by shifting the supply curve outward and lowering prices that consumers have to pay. What is the broader effect of such technology shocks on the economy?
This question actually provides a great example of the interconnections and synergies between microeconomics on the one hand and macroeconomics on the other hand. A positive technology shock can help each individual firm in lowering its costs and being able to offer consumers lower prices. But in the broader macroeconomy, things are even better because what happens is that productivity gets boosted and the whole supply curve of the economy goes out, so the GDP, the gross domestic product, can grow faster and stronger, and everybody prospers because then wages will go up faster.
Finally, a student asked, you mentioned that President Roosevelt established price supports during the Great Depression for wheat and corn and other agricultural products. Did it make sense to raise the price of food during this time when people were having such a hard time making ends meet?
Certainly, a lot of people went hungry during the Great Depression, and it may seem counterintuitive to raise prices for these food products in order to get us out of the Great Depression. But you have to remember this. The problem that the farmers were suffering then was these positive technology shocks, the greater tractors and threshers and fertilizers and everything like that, that was giving them overabundant products, and basically they really couldn't make a living. So they were suffering from these boom and bust cycles. So at the time, the agricultural price supports did serve a purpose to stabilize the farm industry, and it was an important part of recovery of the United States from the Great Depression. And just remember, at the same time that President Roosevelt was doing this, he was also putting money into these public works projects, bridges and roads and libraries that gave people jobs, gave people money to spend, and got the macro economy going again.
This ends Lecture 8.